Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Good afternoon to you all. Lovely day out there. They say it may hit 80 tomorrow. Is this August or is it October? I think we're going to come back to earth. What I've seen of the weather forecast on Monday, we're supposed to be a high about 64, 65. And overnight lows dipping down into the 40s again, 50s and 40s, and well, we'll see how it goes. For those of us heading north to the feast, keep us in your prayers. I think our first few days in Mont-Tremblant, the lows are supposed to be in the 30s, with the possibility of showers. You know what that can turn into when you have possibility of showers? I'm sure it will be lovely. Leaf peeping may be going on, although it may be a bit past peak there by then, but we're certainly looking forward to it. My French is coming along just fine. I will shortly be receiving a little radio thingy so I can plug it in and I can listen to the translation on the days that services are in French. So that's helpful. Well, we are into it. The fall holy day season. 2 days ago, as you've already heard reference, we kept the Feast of Trumpets, always a day that we eagerly wait for, knowing what it ushers in is a 22-day span of time, inclusive 22 days, with the most concise and intense period of instruction about God's plan on the annual calendar. And while the physical isn't the purpose of it, it is certainly not a vacation and shouldn't be viewed that way. On the other hand, probably most of us in God's church have been able to travel to places we might never have ever considered that we could go to or be able to enjoy and share various parts of God's beautiful creation. My wife and I were a little bit nostalgic this morning. We were talking about our trip last year because the feast was just coming to an end at this time. 52 weeks ago today, it was October 7th because of leap year, it advanced a couple of dates, but it was the last great day, or the eighth day, 52 weeks ago, and we remembered, now what did we do the next day? Oh yeah, we drove up to the Volcanoes National Park. We were in Hawaii, so what was that restaurant we ate at? Oh yeah, I remember. So that's the way we often think about the experiences we've had and hope to see more from some of you on November the 2nd. But it all should make us think not only about the overall sweep of God's plan, but also about our part in it. How good is our fit into what God wants for us? How ready are we to join the family and take our place in the plan? How well are we preparing now? I was mulling some of that over not long ago, and I was looking through some old idea files I have, just sifting sermon ideas and bits that I could use in putting things together. And I came across something I had noted and set aside years ago that it provides a way, I think, into the subject I want to talk about today. It's one of those stories that you come across from time to time, and of course much of it now on the internet. I think I found it in a newspaper at the time. But I have no way of knowing totally if it's true or just something somebody dreamed up or was using to illustrate a point. But according to this story, it seems that there was a businessman driving home from work. Now, even that sounds a little strange now because everybody works from home. Well, not everybody, but there's such remote access going on these days, it's changed. According to the story, he was driving along a busy boulevard in a major city in this country. He was quite successful, and he enjoyed some of the financial benefits of his success, including the BMW that he was driving home from his job on this particular day. Suddenly, without warning, a medium-sized rock, it wasn't just a pebble, it wasn't a boulder, but a medium-sized rock crashed into the passenger side of his car. He whipped the car over to the curb and screeched to a halt and strode rather menacingly back toward a 10-year-old boy who was standing on the curb. As the story goes, the boy burst into tears when the man reached him, and then this gentleman saw another boy lying on the grass with an overturned wheelchair beside him. "Please, mister," the boy said, "I'm sorry about your car, but my brother fell out of his wheelchair, and he's too heavy for me to lift him back into it, and I tried to get somebody to stop, and nobody would, and I just didn't know what to do." So, according to this story, the man helped the young boy straighten the wheelchair and set it upright again. And then he lifted the boy's brother into the chair. He reassured them that he was fine and the car would be okay. He could get it repaired. And as he drove away, he was thinking. According to the story I clipped that day, he never did fix the dent in his car. It was a valuable reminder to him of a much greater lesson, that people matter a whole lot more than physical possessions. Don't you think that would also be true of God's plan? People matter a whole lot more than physical possessions. Some of God's people have been, and even to this day in some areas of the world, are grindingly poor. You and I, by comparison, no matter what we think our status is here, would be considered wealthy by some of our brethren in other areas of the world. And God's working with us all. He has a purpose in mind, and He's working it out. Did that story really happen? I don't know. Does it matter? Well, not for our purposes today, really. Here's my question for you today, as you and I have just gotten into the third and last Holy Day season for 2024. What things do we in the Church of God do well? What things do we do well? You know, part of learning to accurately discern and assess things is to be able to discern things you do well, as well as things you need to improve in. And that's important for us all, to have an accurate view, not a skewed view, no matter what. There might be many answers to that question. We might say, well, we keep the Sabbath. That's true. We do. There was a new thing tried this week. I don't know if you tried looking it up. The live online webinar, Life, Hope, and Truth. My wife and I took a look at it last night. There were some glitches. The audio cut out a few times. And we didn't actually listen to all the questions. We got sort of the flavor of them a little bit. And then I want to say went on to deeper things. But deeper things meant... it was a long day Thursday. And we had the chance to share a meal afterwards with the Myerses and the Hensons and the Millers. Marty Miller had just been ordained. I think it was a little bit after 10 when we got home. So yes, we watched for a while and then decided that we needed to study the insides of our eyelids and get a little sleep. But it was interesting. So the Sabbath, that's one of the things that was being discussed. Mr. Franks was talking about the whole concept of, is it the Jewish Saturday? Is that just the Jewish Sabbath? What's the Christian day? What is it? What's it all about? So we might say that. And as a body of believers, whatever our individual strengths or weaknesses might be in that line, we keep the Sabbath. We certainly know that this day is God's holy time. The world cannot grasp that concept for the most part, even those who claim to be Christian. The idea of holy time seems beyond them, for reasons that you heard about in the sermonette from David Rushton. You might say, well, we keep the annual holy days. That takes another step forward, because there are denominations and there are bodies of those who claim to be Christian who do recognize which day the Sabbath is, but they reject the idea of the annual festivals, for reasons that seem good to them, but we certainly disagree. Somebody would say, well, we faithfully practice God's plan of tithing. We know what the money is for. We know the first tenth belongs to Him, and it's to go for the use of forwarding the work of His church, preaching the gospel as a witness, and caring for those that God calls. Same comment, we could say. We believe, in just general terms, the law of God should be kept today. Same comment. There are an awful lot of people who really don't get, when you get down to it, especially the fourth commandment, as that Life, Hope, and Truth webinar was pointing out, they just don't take that approach. And make no mistake, those things do identify us as the people of God. And they do for a long time. They have for a long time. Clear back in Exodus 31, the ancient Israelites were told that my Sabbaths, and it's plural, you shall keep. It shall be a sign between me and you in Exodus 31. So we know that's been around for a long time. And it still is today if properly done. We were talking with some of the friends over dinner, and Mr. Henson had mentioned that he said to his wife as they were driving to church, "Boy, there's a lot of traffic out for a Saturday." Oh, wait a minute. It's not a Saturday. It was a Thursday. And of course, it seemed like it was a very, very short week because yesterday felt like Sunday. And it wasn't. But I know one thing we could surely answer in that question, to that question. We could answer, my wife and I would say, this is very true for us. We know that we do youth camps very well. We've been privileged to be a part of it. Some years back now, the last time we actually were part of a youth camp was, I think, about 7 years ago in 2017. But we worked with churches youth camps most recently over a span of more than 20 years. We know how much camp means to hundreds of our youth, and we do it well. Speaking of the fall feast, we can say we do the Feast of Tabernacles well. Like I said, I just kind of got daydreaming and drifting along today, and just out of curiosity, I just looked up, like, what other airline gets from here to Hawaii? Just in case, you know, just in case there might be a time that might be useful. But the feast is always a highlight of our lives. For many of us, it has been for decades. Many years, most years in fact, I think we have several from other Church of God fellowships who attend the feast with us. We know from Mr. Harper, my wife and I have talked and we spoke to him, that we will have a number like that joining us this year in Mont-Tremblant, Quebec, where we're going. In fact, it could be close to a quarter of the attendance. So we'll see how that turns out. It is from one particular group, and we'll just see. It'll be interesting to us because many years ago, in the late 1980s, I was pastor in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada's capital, which is on the border with Quebec, and it's only about a two-hour drive from the feast site. And we're kind of wondering if we might see any who knew us back then. It is a day or two ago, so we'll see. Now, does that mean that I think we as a body or individually have no problems? That would be naive. Of course not. You heard Mr. Myers identify one of our challenges as a body on trumpets as he led into the ordination ceremony to ordain Mr. Marty Miller into the ministry. That we are in, he said, it's not coming up, we are in a period of a time of generational change in the leadership of the church. I don't think it's any great state secret. At the age of 66, Mr. Myers is the youngest of the administrative team in McKinney. The others are all in their 70s. Somebody else around here is in his 70s, has been for some time. So we are in a time of generational change in the leadership of the church. We should be asking God to send laborers to the harvest, for example. And we're trying something, going back to an old pattern, as he explained in ordaining Marty Miller. So there are always things to acknowledge that we're doing well in, and other areas in which we seek God's help, knowing that that's where the help has to come from. To ask him to send laborers to the harvest is an important part of that right now. For today's topic, subject, I'd like to turn to a pretty familiar section of Scripture. And that's in the Gospel of John, chapter 13. There is a connection. You'll have to tune in closely to pick it up as we go through. John chapter 13. As Jesus Christ was talking, explaining to his disciples, we know the setting of this chapter. This is part of the evening that he was keeping the Passover with his disciples. And in verse 33, he made a point that they were about to be in a time of great transition. They didn't really understand that yet. He said, "Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. If you want a title for the sermon, it's probably just as easy to call it, By This All Will Know. By this all will know. What did he mean by those words? There are two questions that arise from these verses. First question is the phrase love one another really a new commandment? I mean, it sounds pretty familiar even if we go back to the Old Testament. We acknowledge things were different then. One of the ways, of course, you heard earlier, was in the matter of casting lots to determine God's will. Once the Holy Spirit was given on the day of Pentecost, there's no further record of it in the New Testament. The second question is, what is he talking about? What is the love by which others will know that we are Christ's disciples? Surely we see people around us who are caring, loving people. We got a call on Thursday as we were heading out to dinner from Youngstown. Well, they live in Pennsylvania, but from Mrs. Faye Lambert, some of you know, she said, Roger's been in an accident. He was coming home from Trumpets, and he was in an accident. He was on I-79, merging, coming north out of Pittsburgh, and the traffic was merging quickly down from five lanes to three, and all the brake lights started coming on, and his 36 truck didn't quite respond the same way a modern car would, I guess. He didn't hit anybody else, but he started spinning and hit a guardrail and slid down into the median, bumped his head, and had a few other cuts and abrasions. But as it happens, a lady, just a good Samaritan, stopped and, can I help? And there was an ambulance there with EMT to take a look, treat him. He's fine. You can go home. And then one of the members from Pittsburgh happened to be driving past and saw a rather unique 36 blue Chevy truck and said, that's got to be Roger, and said, hey, you need a ride home, don't you? So there are clues in that. Don't tell Roger I told you about this. But, we were a little concerned until we had a little bit more. I talked to him last night at some length, and he said, that's okay. He said, I went down, I said, you got the truck, didn't you? He said, yeah, I brought it back. I'm sure he'll straighten it out and tweak it and work it. I don't know, maybe it'll be purple next time. I don't know, but who knows. So two questions. Is love one another really new? And what kind of love is he talking about? How is it shown? How is it demonstrated? Well, I think we can answer number one fairly quickly. Clearly, Christ meant that something about the way his disciples should obey him and show that love to one another would be new. It would be different. It would be in some fashion an improvement on the past. It wouldn't look exactly like it had in the days when God was working with the patriarchs or when he was working with the nation of Israel. Something was going to be different about it now. And there would be a tie-in, certainly, to the meaning of one of the holy days, and that would be at Pentecost, the coming of God's Spirit, which was in Acts chapter 2. But Matthew 5 and verse 43 is one place we could turn where it actually makes it clear that it was known in the Old Testament to have that approach. You know, Jesus Christ in Matthew 5 and verse 43, he says, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. From the Sermon on the Mount. So, it was around, but something about it was going to be different. The question really is, in what way is this to be new? And that really ties right into the second question of, what are we talking about? What kind of love is it by which others will know that we are Christ's disciples? Because still in Matthew 5 there, he went on to say that it was natural, it was not unusual, it wasn't unheard of to find a bond like that in other areas, in other ways. He went on to say that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, Matthew 5:45. He makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, rain on the just and the unjust. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Interesting take. Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, your family, what do you do more than others? Don't even the tax collectors do so? And then he says something puzzling. Therefore, you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. What's he driving at here with all of this? So, he tells them in Matthew 5 that Christians have to exceed the typical human conduct. You got to do better than that. Clearly, his words in John 13 must mean more than the obvious, which would be that Christians should have an affectionate bond for each other. Fine. We can say, yeah, I like everybody here. Unless they cut in front of me for the snack line. But I like everybody here. It must mean more than that in some fashion, in some way. How? Well, at this point, I'd like to bring in another reference that for the moment might seem unrelated. But this is what I want to wrestle with today. And we want to take a look and see where it ties in. It's in the book of Jude. The book of Jude, one of the general epistles, sandwiched in between 3 John and the book of Revelation. Jude, as we know, was a brother, half-brother then of Jesus Christ. He introduces himself as a bondservant of Jesus Christ and brother of James as he begins this very short epistle that only has the one chapter. But I think you're going to find out that it has something to do with what we're talking about today to answer the questions from John 13. First of all, he talks about a little bit of the history and God working with people. He even references the demons, how they did not keep their proper domain, it says, their own verse 6. He hints about their future, mentions Sodom and Gomorrah. He talks about Michael the archangel contending with Satan about the body of Moses, disputing about that. And then he uses a description, verse 11, that's worthy of a whole sermon all by itself. Woe to them, they've gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and they've perished in the rebellion of Korah. So in summing all that up, he says this in verse 12, that type of attitude, that type of approach, that type of all for the self outlook, he says, these are spots in your love feasts. While they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. And then he morphs into a description of demons even, raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. But he clearly is talking about humans because he adds in verse 14, Enoch, the seventh Madon, prophesied about these men. So it's an attitude that he's getting at, and he gives us some idea of where it comes from. But the interesting description is the very first part of verse 12. These attitudes influenced by Satan, are spots in your love feasts while they feast with you without fear. The word that is translated love feasts, not just love, the word that is translated here in English is the best rendition they could give of it, is agape. Now that's kind of unusual. I think we can recognize something here because we in the Church of God have a culture of keeping the holy days. We immediately recognize this to be some reference to God's feasts and holy days and festivals. Love feasts. That's not a bad way to describe it. Agape is the Greek word translated love feasts here. The only place in the New Testament where that phrase, love feasts, appears. Some texts claim that there ought to be another instance of it in 2 Peter 2, but if you look more closely, you'll find two different Greek words being used, the other one being apatais, A-P-A-T-A-I-S. They're very closely resembling each other, but it's not the same. Due to popular usage in evangelical churches, agape is a word that's pretty familiar to a lot of people claiming to be Christian these days. You'll often hear it, a reference to it. But its connection or correlation to holy days isn't commonly known or understood. You and I would look at this verse and think holy days. But the world doesn't view it that way. It has led to all kinds of puzzlement and some unique, strange ideas about it. Bible commentators, on the other hand, tend to be more focused just on the Greek words themselves. They're trying to analyze the language. And so some of them, several different commentaries you can pick up, perceive that there's something unique with this word being used this way here. It is the most commonly used word for love in the New Testament, and it's always referring to a godly kind of love. But what is this usage here? Here's one comment from Wesley's explanatory notes. It says, the feasts of love were anciently observed in all the churches. What? What are you talking about? That comment is not a reference to the holy days that we think of, but it's referring to what we recognize to be false Christianity and how they try to deal with the whole thing here. Some religious leaders recognized a unique implication to this word translated love feast, but how in the world were they to fit that into their schedule when they didn't keep the annual holy days? It was a puzzle. That was their challenge. So since they'd thrown away the knowledge of the holy days, the only celebration that the early church fathers, of course, all Catholic when you say early church fathers, the only celebration they could link with the concept of a love feast was the Passover, which they called Eucharist or Communion. Now we've got a problem, don't we? Because if you attempt to apply the true concept of this reference here, love feasts in Jude 12, some of them then taught their denominations to have a meal with the symbols of the bread and the wine. Does anything pop to your mind immediately? How about 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul calls the Corinthian church to task for saying, how is it when you come together for the Passover, you know, some of you are hungry and some of you, he said, this isn't to keep the Lord's Supper. So that doesn't make sense. It was not to eat the Lord's Supper. That's not what the Passover is about. Others did realize that Paul taught against tying it to Passover, so they had what they called private fellowship meals. If you go way, way back in early church histories, you'll find references to just fellowship meals. Small groups of believers, often in their homes, and they called them agape meals. Fellowship agape meals. Well, it sounds like a good idea, but historically, as people's lives tended to morph away from close involvement in church as community, those agape meals stopped in most places too altogether. Here's another Bible dictionary. This one's a little more, in some ways, more like a Bible study today, but it's Holman Bible Dictionary says this, and it's kind of insightful. The origin of the love feast is probably to be found in the religious fellowship meals, which were a common practice among the first century Jews. While the Passover meal is the most familiar of these, I would say to people that concentrate only on the New Testament, such meals were also celebrated to inaugurate the Sabbath and the festival days. Now, you and I can say, okay, that's starting to make more sense. With the experience and perspective that observing the holy days give us, let's look again at John 13, verses 34 and 35. Remember our two questions. Is this really new? And what is he talking about? What kind of love is it that would identify us to everybody and all the world around us in some ways as being his disciples? Of course, the word here in John 13, 34 and 35 is agape. I'm sure you would realize that. Remember, this is in effect one of the things Jesus Christ said his servants would do well. they would do well at this. By this all will know that you are my disciples. That's a compliment. That's a commendation. You're doing it well. Naturally, it would be a distortion to imply that I don't want everybody to go back to the New Testament now and get out their, you know, their lexicons and look up every use of the word agape and say it's always got to be talking about the holy days. No, it's not. Not always talking about the holy days. That's not my point. But at the same time, you and I know that God has a way of subtly dropping hints as we learn and go through His Word. And things begin to pile and add on to each other and give deeper meaning to the other things that went before. What if, because there's a consistency and a continuity in the Scriptures, what if we keep in mind that this one unique usage of the word agape in Jude 12, translated love feasts, and take a look at some of the other places where the word is used and ask ourselves a question about the holy days that you and I keep? It ought to be very fresh in our memory. Just 2 days ago, we kept the Feast of Trumpets. I hope that we can all remember what we felt like on that day. I think we can. What was it like to walk into the hall for services? To see people that maybe from one of the other congregations you don't see often? What's it like to spend some time together, maybe have some lunch together with someone, perhaps join others for dinner afterwards, whatever? What is the feel that you get at keeping God's holy days? What was it that made Jude use that word for something that we would say clearly has overtones of the holy days? These are spots on your love feast. They feast with you without fear. That's why the translators put that in there. What's really happening at the feast or on other holy days throughout the year? What do the festivals of God showcase? What's Jude trying to tell us? With that question kind of nagging at us in the back of our minds, it can make a pretty interesting study to look at a couple of other scriptures, a handful, that use the word agape. Turn to Romans 13. And again, remember, we're trying to answer a couple of questions. What's new about the command to love one another? And what kind of love would even show itself, make a connection in the minds of other people with us to being disciples of Jesus Christ? Romans 13. There was a question about taxes that he had answered. It came up, but this time he's just talking about the reason we pay taxes. Verse 7, it says, render to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And then he says something unusual. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Now that introduces another concept. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. If there's any other commandment, it's all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. We've heard the last six of the Ten Commandments summarized that way. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. That should be giving us a little bit of a hint and a little bit of a connection to Jude 12. What if we brought this word here, by the way, is agapao. It's very close. It's related to agape. It means to welcome hospitably, entertain socially in a warm and gracious manner. But in verse 10, the word agape is used. 8 has agapao. 10 has agape. If we brought in the question, what's really happening here on this scripture? What if we took the idea of the way you felt Thursday walking into the Feast of Trumpets? The way the atmosphere was, it's almost an electric feel with more people there and it's just different. What if you use that as a template and overlaid it on this scripture? Would it tell us anything? Here, the concept of love feast would be harmoniously braided in thought with God's law. Does that fit? I think it does. Is that something we do well? I believe it does. I hope so. Can yet do better. But even more to the point, what does it tell us about how we are to fulfill Jesus Christ's words in John 13? One of the ways, apparently here, is we must be very, very encouraging and very, very determined to be obedient to Him. And it comes through in the way we treat other people. It comes through in the way we treat others. What about another angle? The search to find the true disciples of Jesus Christ includes finding the true God. So let's go to 1 John. First John chapter 2. My little children, verse 1, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. Now that seems to tie into what we just read. Keeping God's law. If anyone sins, we do have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. He himself is the propitiation, or the mercy seat. Sometimes it's even translated the forgiveness for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the whole world. Now, by this we know that we know Him, if we keep His commandments. He who says, I know Him, and doesn't keep His commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. That's pretty strong. But whoever keeps His word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in Him. He who says he abides in Him ought himself also to walk just as he walked. How many times do you run into a situation where someone that you know professes to be a follower of Christ, says, I'm a Christian, but then not just an occasional misstep or faceplant, but as a pattern of life, it just doesn't match. We're not making a final judgment saying, I know where you're going to end up. That's not the point. That's God's call. But can we identify what we're seeing? The thing is, about Jude 12, apparently some others can too. Do we set that kind of an example, brethren, that even other people can tell there's something different about those folks? Something different. It talks about being perfected in Him. Sounds like a reference to eventual salvation. Do we need a working knowledge of the love feast in order to understand God and His plan? You bet we do. You bet we do. To fully grasp the potential for human salvation? I'd say so. It started with the Feast of Trumpets, but as we go from here to the Day of Atonement and see the meaning of the binding of Satan to not be able to influence humans again, to head then into the millennial reign of Christ, pictured by tabernacles, and the wonderful picture of the eighth day, the last great day, of the culmination, the bringing of tying up all the loose ends of God's plan so that everyone will have the opportunity. It's all tied up in the feast. Even some other Church of God groups that do not keep the annual holy days are missing something. Missing something. Keep in mind Christ's words from the Gospel of John. By the way, I should mention too, there's the other flip side of that coin. There are some groups that have some working knowledge of the annual festivals. That doesn't automatically mean that they get everything. The presence of God's Spirit is the answer. After all, if you go back keeping the annual holy days, if you go back to the minor prophets, to Amos chapter 5, I won't turn there, but you'll find in Amos 5, there was a place God said there He actually hated their feast days. You might say, well, what do you mean? How could He hate the feast days He gave them? Well, His point was, the way that people kept them back then, it was an affront to Him to claim to be His, to even be gathering together on these correct dates, but living their lives in a way that had nothing to do with His direction. The hearts of the people weren't right. Something was wrong with the way they tried to keep his feast, which meant something was wrong with their lives. They weren't even close to fulfilling John 13, even if they could have known about it back in those days. What's the common thread in all this? Well, it's just this. Going through the motions doesn't cut it. We've said before, and you've heard it said, we don't come here just to warm a seat. We're here because it means something. To fellowship together with those of like mind. We even say that. There's something special about that. What are all of our backgrounds? You know, we had a little game at one of our socials last winter where you were trying to find somebody who had a certain background. Can you find somebody who's a twin? Can you find somebody who did this? Can you find somebody who was this way? Can you find somebody who had this part of it? And we were all going around, and you know why it worked? Because we're all from different backgrounds. If we were all identical, it would have been, I can find one of them, two, you know, three, the common thread. But we had all kinds of differences. And sure enough, that, what was it, 5x5 or 6x6, we were able to, several of us were able to fill it all out. And we were able to find somebody who matched every one of those descriptions. Because we're different. Going through the motions doesn't cut it. But truly keeping God's feasts in the way He intended, a very big part of fulfilling the idea and the spirit and the intent and the heart of John 13. It helps foster a sense of community and togetherness and family. How many times have you heard reference to my church family? How many times have you thought that way or felt that way or expressed appreciation that way? Sometimes even those who don't walk this way can spot that. That's beginning to get pretty close to the expansion of our understanding. Remember, I did want to say that I was going to mention things the church did well. A feast, I believe, is one of them. Here's another reference, 1 Corinthians 13. You probably know exactly what that chapter, that scripture is about. 1 Corinthians 13. It's the love chapter. And, of course, the word is agape. As you read through that chapter, ask yourself if some of the things that pop up and come to mind are in your mind associated with your church family and sometimes with getting together with that church family on these wonderful special annual occasions that we have 7 times a year. Does your life revolve around, in one sense, in planning methods? Does it revolve around planning the holy days? I don't think it would be too likely that most of us would think in terms of dating things by pagan festivals anymore. You and I are not likely to say, well, it was just before Christmas that we did this. I don't think so. We're likely to say, it was right after the feast one year, but I can't remember which year it was. Or I know it was just before Passover. Or it was Pentecost was late that year. We were already into the summer. Or something like that. That's how we tend to date things, time things. That's a key. 1 Corinthians 13 is about what it really means with godly love. The Spirit of God motivating us, driving us, helping us be more like He is. And as you read through there, like I said, do memories start popping into your mind? The idea, perhaps, that Jude had in mind when he said a love feast. And is it any connection to John 13? Again, I'm not saying you should go into here in 1 Corinthians 13 and translate it love feast every place. Though I give my body to be burned, I have not love feasts. It profits me nothing. No, that's not the point. But people experienced with keeping the festivals as they should be kept, with the Spirit and love of God, have a richer understanding of what this kind of a relationship is. Why? They understand the concept of building an atmosphere of obedience and godliness among a group of people. And when you get right down to it, isn't that going to be our job in the kingdom? The city of Corinth, we're in 1 Corinthians, the city of Corinth is a pretty good illustration of this whole thing. The fact that God often calls people that would not normally or naturally bond together. in this kind of a relationship. Christians may well find they have to work harder with the help of God's Spirit to accomplish the kind of bonding that comes naturally to a fraternity or an organization or a family where people have so much in common already. Maybe you've had the occasion sometime to reconnect with family members you hadn't seen for years, and it's special. I remember one cousin of mine a few years ago that just due to family difficulties and tragedies and challenges, the family had lost contact over the years. And I had one cousin that I had not seen for 60 years. And we reconnected in 2017, as it turned out, sadly, just about a year before her death. But it was marvelous. We sat and talked about things. We began to understand things we hadn't understood before about what happened, of what caused the family to drift apart. And I wish we'd had more time together. We were going back for a second visit, and 3 days before we were to leave, she died. But there's going to be a whole lot more to talk about in the resurrection. Well, that's because we had a commonality. We knew different, you know, the same family members. We were related. But that's not what we have in God's church. You and I, we're different. Don't know that any of us are, too many of us are that related here. There are some family groupings, yes. But for the rest of us, here's a quote from Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary about Corinth. It says, at Corinth, the Apostle Paul established a flourishing church made up of a cross-section of the worldly-minded people who had flocked to Corinth to participate in the gambling, legalized temple prostitution, business adventures, and amusements available in a first-century navy town. That's quite a place to have a church of God. You might think, well, it's probably, you know, I don't know, 100 to 200 people. The city soon became a melting pot for the approximately 500,000 people who lived there at the time of Paul's arrival. 500,000 population. Merchants and sailors, anxious to work the docks, migrated to Corinth. Professional gamblers and athletes betting on the Isthmian Games took up residence. Slaves, sometimes freed but with no place to go, roamed the streets day and night. Prostitutes, male and female, were abundant. People from Rome, the rest of Greece, Egypt, Asia Minor, all of the Mediterranean world relished the lack of standards and the freedom of thought that prevailed in the city. Sounds all too modern in some ways, doesn't it? These were the people who eventually made up the Corinthian church. They had to learn to live together in harmony, although their national, social, economic, and religious backgrounds were very different. We're beginning to get down to some clues here. How did Paul teach them to work together? He had a very clever analogy. He didn't tell them to look at each other as if they were all the same. You know what they would have done if he had said that? They said, well, no, we're not. I'm nothing like, you know, over there. And those people that sit on the other side of the room, no, you know. He said this. He said they should look at each other as a body with many parts. 1 Corinthians 12. They weren't drawn together because they were all the same, or they shared similar interests, or they were family, or they joined the same clubs, did all the same things. That would be easy by comparison. That would be how the world does it. How the world builds bonds. You seek out those who are like you. It shows up in politics, for example. And it shows up in all kinds of other places. Instead, they would do it the way God wants His people to do it. They would do it with appreciation and sensitivity for the abilities and, yes, the weaknesses of others who were very unlike them. The way that God's Spirit would work and could join and could bond and could make something that was a tool in His hands. How? With God's Spirit. With godly love, with agape. And one way that Jude apparently picked up on that it was revealed was on the annual feast days. But sometimes, as Jude said, others came in who didn't belong. And he said, these attitudes, these backgrounds, this approach, this thought, these are spots in your love feasts. And he says, this is what they're like. There's another very familiar spot, and that's Galatians 5. We're told in verse 13 there, we're told through love, agape, we should serve one another. And the very next verse, God's law is quoted. And then you drop down to verse 22 and you find the fruits of God's Spirit following the works of the flesh, Galatians 5. The fruit of the Spirit of God, when you say love, joy, peace, we're not talking about it's just something social. We're talking about a bonding together. We're talking about a binding into one body. More like the concept, maybe, that Jude had in mind when he wrote love feasts. Again, it's not that agape should be translated as love feasts in the fruits of God's Spirit. It's just love. It's just that using the whole idea from Jude 12 like a template to overlay these familiar places can give us a little bit more meaning. Paul did say, against those fruits of God's Spirit, there is no law. How about one more? Hebrews 10, just one more reference. Familiar statements here, familiar exhortation. Hebrews 10, verse 24. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. That gives some of the sense I'm talking about. We consider each other. We try to help each other. We try to encourage each other. And that takes an approach of love that doesn't come from what would naturally have brought us together. And then he says, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. Can we treat each other like that? The word is agape. How appropriate is it that we should be urged to stir up the spirit of what you and I experience on God's holy days? What a joyful time they are. You know, it drives me nuts when I see the world around us trying so hard to do something of a counterfeit with other holidays. One of the campaigns that drives me the most nutsiest, probably not very grammatical, is when you see these things that say, Christmas in July. I'm thinking, oh, we have to deal with it. You know, it used to start when I don't want to say that phrase. When I would never. But I remember when Christmas didn't start until after Thanksgiving. That goes way back. Now it starts in July. And it starts even before one of those other favorite days of ours, Halloween. I was being very facetious. Where does it all come from? Where should you and I be coming from? That's the point. I don't know if the story about the man with the BMW and the little boy with the rock is true. But I do know this. As the disciples of Christ, we must hold to the commandments that he taught. Without question, it is most important that we keep the days that God set and at the times he decreed. And you and I are smack in the middle of one of those amazing seasons. 2 days ago, we kept the Feast of Trumpets. One week from today will be the Day of Atonement. A very special day. Yes, a very hungry day. But a day that helps us focus on some amazing needs of our world. This world needs the meaning of the Day of Atonement. Because it can't go from the Day of Atonement to the Feast of Tabernacles without it. It can't go from the Feast of Trumpets and the return of Christ and the resurrection of the saints and the changing of the saints to the millennial reign of Christ without the binding of Satan. Every step rings true. Of equal, if not greater importance than just the times and just the dates and just following procedure is the manner, how we keep the feasts of God. The spirit of love, a very special, it's just a special atmosphere that must be part and parcel of keeping the commandments and obedience to God too. Let's go back to John 13 one more time. Maybe if I put the accent a little differently as I read through it, it will come clearer. The word know means, in verse 35, in both English and Greek, to perceive, to come to an understanding by experience and knowledge. Let me read this verse again. By this all will know that you have love, that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. You with your diverse backgrounds, you with your diverse ages, different ethnicities, different almost everything. The world's going to look at that and say, look at the way this group of people has been bound together. Where do they get it all? They are so different. You look at this one over here and that one over there, and they're so different, but look at this. If you have love for one another, God can say, and His Son can say, this is a real sign of what my Spirit can do in human beings. And it's an indication, a little hint, of what His plan holds out for the future of mankind. Does that solve our mystery? Maybe so. People looking for the disciples of Christ should gain from those disciples information about what it's like to bond and build different people together to form a body, Paul's analogy. All from very unlike backgrounds who learn how to mesh and fit and work together and accomplish more than they could on their own. They learn that in part through the various education programs we have to preach the gospel. They can find some of it online or even ordering literal literature. But in addition to what they can know intellectually, there's a way to experience on a much deeper level. Jude, the love feasts of Jude 12. The best way they can do that is when they come into contact with you and me, true Christians, who according to God's directives and commands will be keeping, among other things, the holy days in the spirit He intends. By this, the concept of a love feast, Jesus Christ could say, everyone will know that you're my disciples. Maybe that's why sometimes we so often have visitors among us during the feast. Maybe there's something there that they just feel they need. That feast is getting closer and closer and closer. Have a great rest of the Sabbath.